Welcome to Biota Live. I'm Tom Barbalay, and this is a continuation of the Biota Podcasts. For more information on the Biota Podcasts, go to biota.org/podcast. Well, we have two callers on the line. Hello, first caller.
Hello there.
Hello, Gerald. Good to talk to you.
Yes.
Hello, second caller.
Hi, Bruce here.
Hi, Bruce. Good to talk to you again this evening.
Our pleasure.
So we have some news and notes, and then we'll get into this evening's topic. For folks who are also interested in calling in, we have a call-in number via Blog Talk Radio. The number is 646-200-0640. For folks who don't want to call the US number but are listening through Blog Talk Radio, there is an active chat room, which means you can participate. You can ask questions of the assembled guests or contribute ideas, basically, to the Internet radio show as it goes on. Well, before every show, I try to think of a topic for the next show, and it just so happened I had my YouTube video window up of my ever-growing tomato garden, and I thought we hadn't actually talked about the artificial life of plants yet. I was reading through Maciej Komenczynski's collection a couple of nights ago, and I saw the Nerve Garden project discussed by Bruce and friends. And it occurred to me that we should probably talk about the artificial life of plants, both as something that can appear in future games, but also as a kind of subphylum of artificial life in terms of the aspects that one uses to simulate plants and things of this nature. Bruce, your friend in Paris, do you think he'd be interested in participating in such a conversation?
I think so. You know, they did the Darwin's Park platform, which is big extension of where we left off with Nerve Garden, and so I think that would be a really good addition to the program.
So to avoid him waking up at 5 a.m. on Saturday morning in Paris, perhaps we could work out whether or not he'd be able to make it, and maybe we'll do a 10 a.m. Saturday version of the podcast, 10 a.m. Pacific. We'll confirm that through biota.org/podcast through the week as we get in contact with Claude and his team with regards to the potential of him appearing on a Biota Live. Following up on last week, I've had some more correspondence with regards to folks interested in Biota CDs, but just to repeat from last week's announcement, we are doing a press for Artificial Life 11, and we will have plenty, hundreds, in fact, of additional CDs, and we are looking to send them to universities and institutions that would be able to put them in ideal locations or pass them out to students or pass them out to researchers or basically just get the message of the Biota podcast out to folks that have not yet discovered it. That's the purpose of having the CDs out there. So if you're interested in that, please get in contact, tom@nobleape.com. I have received quite a few emails through the week, and I've assembled the packing boxes, so all we need is the CDs now to send them out, but that will be coming very shortly. Great news. Well, somewhat fortuitously, there is almost a simulcast of Graytham, because both Gerald in the Netherlands and Bruce in Silicon Valley, San Francisco, you're both doing Graythams on the 24th of June. Gerald, this you weren't on last week. Would you like to talk a little bit about the Graytham meeting in the Netherlands?
It's going to be on Tuesday night, and it'll be different from Silicon Valley because there's 9 hours of difference. So we won't be actually at the same time, unfortunately. But it's impossible for me to predict exactly what's going to happen, who's going to come, and you know, it's an informal thing, and this is the very first time. I've invited a whole bunch of people. We have probably a fairly significant number of people, but I still have no idea who or whatever. You know, anybody can say they'll come and then they eventually don't. So I'm just, as far as I'm concerned, if there are five or six people and we have an interesting discussion, it's perfect. We have a really wonderful location for it, which is a building from like the 16th, 17th century. It was a building used for the VOC company when they were working in the colonies. And now it's surrounded by a huge area of building activity. So it's like a total mess, this part of town. And we're in this old, old building that's been completely redone with recycling in mind. So all the furniture and everything is made of old materials. And it's a location where people will have a lot of sort of cultural events and you know, screenings of unusual movies and music performances and things like this. So it's a really, really cool location. I hope we get a good group of people to come.
And was I right in my assessment last week? Will this be done almost simultaneously with other art installations and other goings on? Will you have a flux of people coming through?
I don't think so. It's an evening at a building where they have one section is a really nice bar that's largely made of wood, and they've got everything supplied, and there's a bunch of tables around and stuff. So it's and a stage. That's where they usually have the music performances. But I think the evening there is more or less dedicated to Grey Thumb. And like downstairs, they still have things going on. They have a sort of a music store and a, you know, a bookstore built into the same building.
And long-term Biota correspondent Rudolf Penikoff will be there as well. He's going to be demonstrating something too. Is it a kind of show and tell after you've done the formal presentation with regards to Darwin at Home? Is there a show and tell component to it as well?
Well, there's, I wouldn't call it that formal. What I've got now is I'm setting up for two short presentations. One of them will be sort of a kickoff to introduce everybody and get things going and tell a bit of the history of Grey Thumb and whatever. And my second presentation will be describing the Nuance Engine and showing it to the people. So, but this is not a huge thing. It's going to be just, as far as I'm concerned, a really interesting, you know, food for conversation. And Rudolf is also going to make a presentation. I was happy to hear that, because then it's not all me, so I can sort of shift off to him. And I actually hope it's you know, we're talking about presentations, but what I'd prefer is that we just sort of you know, have enough to talk about, that we just spend our time, you know, kicking up our feet and exchanging philosophies. That's one of the coolest things about artificial life, is that there's a lot of philosophy to be had, of course, because, you know, you get the first question is, what is life? Which brings me to one point just now. I was listening to you on the Apologia podcast, and what you just said when you started this show is something I wanted to highlight as well. Something I was planning on mentioning, but you already got me on it. You're already first to mention it, because there's often a discussion about artificial life being self-aware, or being what is it? Is it intelligence or is it not, or whatever. These questions always sort of assume that we're talking about artificial life that resembles something, you know, something sentient, or something, you know, intelligent, or semi-intelligent. But if you talk about artificial life of plants, which happens to be more or less what I'm doing now when I'm trying to evolve, you know, buildings, what I want is to develop static things now, not necessarily static, but you know, things that are not intended to move eventually, they're intended to stand still, which is more or less, you know, developing plant life. And that really, in a sense, lowers the bar. You know, it also raises the interestingness of the question, you know, when does it look like life? Because if it looks like a plant, it must look like life. You know, plant is life, which really lowers the bar. You know, it doesn't have to be running around and thinking and talking back to you.
Certainly. And, I mean, if you look at reefs and things like that, there are lots of things that look like plants that are, in some regard, animals as well. And it's in fact, quite a curious blur. But returning to Greytham news, we probably should accept some form of formality before we get into the deeper philosophical issues of this evening's discussion. Bruce, I've been receiving a lot of correspondence through the week about the event in San Francisco on the 24th of June as well. Would you like to talk a little bit about that, please?
It's really going to be an exciting meeting. You know, this is our third get-together and our second formal meeting, and it will be at the Internet Archive in the Presidio in San Francisco, which is an old historic military house or building that Brewster Kahle set up this massive archive organization. And the presentations we'll have are Jeffrey Ventrella, who works at the archive and who many of the listeners know from Gene Pool and other projects. He's going to show some other work that isn't Gene Pool. And we're really looking forward to seeing that and talk about the new versions of Gene Pool. And John Cumbers, who's someone I met at NASA Ames just by accident, who's a synthetic biologist, who's going to bring for the first time, at least to our group, concepts of sort of wet artificial life, building the building blocks of life through chemistry rather than through software. And, of course, there's a merger here because if we can do simulations of chemical things, we can simulate sort of the origins of biological chemical life, possibly. And so there will be actually a number of other people who will do cameo demos and appearances at this meeting. So I think this one's really going to be a packed meeting up at the archive.
Yes, I think the show-and-tell formula is something that we've discussed with regards to Greytham Boston. But, I mean, if Gerald's seen the videos of the first formal Silicon Valley meeting, the ability to kind of go around a table and have people introduce themselves and discuss their particular interests can very quickly move into a kind of show-and-tell component as well. Certainly fielding correspondence with regards to both Greytham's in Silicon Valley and in the Netherlands, my sense is that these things will continue to build momentum and the new faces will probably be part of some degree of introduction as well. Gerald, was I right in my recollection that you and Justin Lyon were going to be meeting in Rome sometime?
Yeah, that wasn't entirely certain, and in the end it didn't happen.
Right. We were hoping to link up with Justin sometime in the next month as well as he assists with the setup of a university in Iraq. Have you heard any more on that?
Not a lot, no. I talked to him just once after that, and very briefly.
Okay. Well, paging Justin Lyon and the related Simudyne folk that may have some knowledge of that, because I think that was certainly something that got a lot of excitement. Well, Gerald, you've stolen my news with regards to the Apologia podcast. The audio is now out, and yes, raised a number of interesting points of discussion with regards to this evening's topic. For folks interested in participating, we have an active chat window, and we also have a call-in number. The call-in number is 646-200-0640. The topic for this evening is, what is the philosophy of artificial life? And I think from our discussion last week, Bruce, we were able to establish pretty clearly that the philosophy of artificial life may be one of the greatest means to bring folks from a wide variety of other intellectual disciplines and discourse and popular thought into artificial life. And it's also a great means for existing artificial life practitioners to apply principles in artificial life to a wide variety of other topics. So it's a fascinating field. In terms of the history of artificial life philosophy, and again, there is no, I was trying to find a coherent history. I went back to Margaret A. Bowden's book and picked up at least the table of contents from Amazon. And a wide variety of folk contributed. Tom Ray, Mark Boudot, who's obviously appeared in previous podcasts, Christopher Langton, Margaret A. Bowden herself, and a couple of philosophers that were writing on primary work. A fellow by the name of David Kirsch, who wrote with regards to Rodney Brooks' work, And also, I want to say John Maynard Smith, although it's gotten past me, who's now the late evolutionary biologist, and various other interesting folk were in that book. But in terms of the philosophy of artificial life, I think there's a number of practitioners that believe that it predates computation, and some that say it starts with Freeman Dyson. Gerald, when I say to you the philosophy of artificial life, where do you think its origins come from?
I would say, there's been philosophy for many, many centuries about life itself. Well, what is it, and what are we? And artificial life is just sort of a new branch of that, where we're performing a kind of a thought experiment, because we're not looking at artificial life and saying, oh, there's an example of it, so what does that mean? And there's an example of it, and what does that mean? We're still asking the question, what is it? What does it mean? How do we draw the line and things like this? So it's an extension of that same traditional philosophical question of what is life and what are we doing here?
So it's an interesting dichotomy between theoretical and applied philosophy in that regard, because, what you're describing is a kind of continued narrative of theoretical philosophy, but what interests me, and particularly with regards to contemporary discussions like the Apologia podcast, is there is also now an applied philosophy of artificial life that Margaret A. Boughton's book touched on, but now folks such as myself regularly kind of throw our fists into, in terms of using artificial life simulations as critiques of things as disparate as kind of ethics and metaphysics and all these kind of components of philosophy. What's your thinking with regards to this distinction of kind of continuing thought experiments in one regard and also actually having quantifiable means through simulation in another regard?
I'm not sure what you mean by the second aspect here.
Well, if you look at a lot of contemporary applied philosophy, it relates to concepts of whether we could live in simulations or whether what we are perceiving are fundamentally Cartesian kind of questions, but framed in a very contemporary setting with regards to contemporary computation, certainly questions of the mind and things of this nature as well. And this is something that artificial life developers in some regard have primary connection with in terms of writing simulations and tinkering with these kind of things. We are actually dealing with the tools that these philosophers are describing. And I think that's a very powerful way that artificial life developers can kind of raise their hand and say, sorry, sir, it's not quite like that. Or if you read Nick Bostrom, for example, he's at Oxford. He talks about simulation in a very, very grand scale, and as you know, developing Darwin at Home, as Bruce knows, with regards to his nerve gun development, you can simulate just a localized area, particularly with regards to movement, and kind of cover the distant world in creating a simulation and get quite interesting and thought-provoking answers. In fact, get far more interesting and far more thought-provoking answers than people that talk about these things in a kind of cusp between applied and theoretical in some regard, because they have no real applied standing. They're merely just using contemporary computing as a means of framing their particular philosophical argument. So in this regard, I think artificial life developers have a very strong means to actually communicate back into this kind of applied philosophy. But if we return to the thought experiment aspect of what has existed, as you said, for centuries, how do you see this mapping onto to artificial life development? Is it something where we are testing the thought experiments, or we're merely just contributing to additional thought experiments?
Yeah, well, we're building an ever more effective mirror on ourselves, and that's always food for thought. I was a little disappointed during the Apologia podcast that you didn't bring up intelligent design there, Tom.
Well, there were a number of topics that I thought coming into it. In fact, I was I'm not sure if you've listened to the Apologia stream, and this is probably admitting far too much to the general public, but my feeling is that they tend to digress very quickly if particular topics were raised. So with regards to a number of things where I appear to skirt around a few quite obvious points, I intentionally avoided it because I had listened to the back catalogue of Apologia and realised if I raised even a small number of buzzwords, immediately things were going to digress very rapidly. The irony is, at the conclusion of the recording, as you've heard, they said, Well, we need to come back and actually discuss everything that Tom has talked about in a more full setting. So my feeling is, I think they called it Artificial Life 1. My feeling is that there may be a 2, a 3, and a 4, which I won't actively participate in. So it was all very curious in that regard. But yes, I did avoid a wide variety of hot-button topics. And to some degree, I don't think I would actively promote my appearance on the Apologia podcast aside from this collection of friends that listen to Biota Live, because I think more critical minds would certainly make the points that you've made. So, Bruce, when we talk about the philosophy of artificial life, when we talk about it in terms of both theoretical and applied philosophy, what does it resonate with you?
I'm such a sort of an engineer pragmatist that I guess I always look for, you know, what is the thing that you're building? What is the question you're trying to answer? So, for example, we ended last week's podcast with this whole idea that maybe the origins of artificial life were the tornado challenge that Dick Gordon presented in his book chapter is actually the most important challenge artificial life could take on. And that, just to clarify that, I think it came out of Fred Hoyle, one of Fred Hoyle's comments in the 80s, that if a tornado went through a junkyard of parts, would it blow all the parts together to make a 747? You know, what's the probability of that? And I'm not quite, I'll have to, the reference was. But what Dick Gordon says is, he said, you have to go way back. You have to say, can artificial life take on this challenge of starting from really a fairly undifferentiated soup, not building any mechanics, not building any artifice, like building an existing sort of genetic system, starting from a soup and start with basic physics, basic statistics, and running it and seeing whether you do get some elements that start to create replicators and start to create vessels around replicators, or the other way around, and then start to replicate based on blueprints, and then forward the blueprints, because I think that's the canonical model of life. And if you were able to do that, and actually he asked me to write a quick tagline to his chapter before it goes off to final press, so I wrote a tagline based on listening to the podcast last week that said, the evil grid, maybe that is the ultimate goal of the evil grid idea, is to go that far back and make that grand challenge of starting from a real sandbox approach. And that if in the 21st century we're able to do this, we're able to, you know, from nothing beget, or have the nothingness beget, the copy model or the copy rule occurs, then we've shed light on many things, including whether or not life could arise out of a chemical soup, whether the universe possesses the property of doing that. Go ahead, Gerald.
What bothers me here is that, you know, if you're talking artificial life in terms of in silico, then the idea of replication is basically no big deal. You know, replication is just a question of executing the right commands that make a copy of a certain chunk of memory, and that's the most common, boring thing that you could possibly do. So when people come up with, miniature instruction sets and then fill the memory with random garbage and then just run whatever, set the program pointer wherever they want, do that a million times eventually, when you have a deck of cards that stacks all the way up to the moon, you're going to get a royal flush somewhere in there, so... replication is, of course, core to this whole idea. Whenever you get something that replicates, you have the potential to, be set up against the challenge of selection and have some interesting things happen. So when you have a replicator based on a genome, you're good to go. And the magic is that it happened in biology. But I really... put question marks beside the idea that it's magical in a computer.
So to divert the topic slightly from this, what interests me with regards to these ideas of the future of biota, particularly raised in a kind of philosophical context, is the ability of the artificial life community to actually get it out to a broader audience. This is a familiar theme last week and also in the Ethologia podcast. Bruce, at the end of last week's podcast, you talked about not only the ideas of big science, but also the potential for this kind of project to be framed in something that the Richard Dawkins Foundation would talk about or other similar organizations. And I reflect, because we're having the amazing meeting here in Las Vegas currently, that there are all these groups that you would think would naturally converge on artificial life as being natural companions in some regard. But certainly my experiences with regards to biota has shown that to be anything but the case. And it's a curious thing, and this is something that was raised in the Apologia podcast specifically with regards to Kurzweil. Why aren't these people actively coming back to us, and why is it so difficult for us to get our ideas out to these kind of communities? What's your thinking on this, Bruce?
Well, as far as Ray goes, I worked for him for a year and a half getting statistics for his book, the Singularity book, and I've met with him a number of times. And I have to say, you know, he's a practitioner of pop culture, so his ideas are not based on engineering or science or anything. It's a pop culture idea. And so, in a sense, for him or that type of dialogue to engage with artificial life, it's very tough because we're so nuts and bolts oriented. We're so we need definitions, we need algorithms, we need all this sort of stuff. We're not very fun.
I'm going to ask you a loaded question with regards to having Gerald on the line as well. Do you feel the same way with regards to Richard Dawkins?
Well, you mean for myself?
Well, in terms of getting information into Richard Dawkins' spheres.
When I sat with him 5 or 6 years ago and talked about doing an artificial life prize, a competition and prize, he understood it completely and was very positive about it, being involved with it. So I think that he straddles the world, in the world of biology, and he understands the artificial life world, and he, of course, straddles the world of religion and philosophy now. So he's sort of a strong...
But also popular culture as well, as Kurzweil does.
Yeah, although I think Dawkins doesn't stray too far from something that he can really point to a lot of background work on. I mean, he doesn't make the kind of pronouncements that Ray Kurzweil does. Predictions of the future, for example, which is a dangerous business.
Sorry, that Dawkins didn't really pursue the idea of a meme very far. He said this is something for other people with more expertise in this area to search out.
Yeah, and it's a conservative, cautious approach, and that's the mark of someone from science. And when Kurzweil's not from science or scientific tradition, and he's not really from an engineering tradition either. I mean, he's a business leader and a thought leader for a certain group. So I think Dawkins has much more affinity for a serious artificial life effort, and I plan to approach him again once I get this PhD topic further along. I have a feeling I've got a long way to go, but I'll be in the UK 2-3 times a year, and I'll try to get the opportunity to go and see him or his colleagues.
See if you can get Gerald along as well, because Gerald sent him birthday cards, so they're on speaking terms.
Wow.
Birthday cards.
Sorry, I've been reviewing that podcast as well, so it sticks in my mind. But returning to the idea of the philosophy of artificial life, these folk obviously have a group of philosophers that follow them along and follow their particular traditions and get into a popular narrative based on that. But something that again came through in the Apologia podcast is that there must be a new generation of artificial life philosophers that are in some regards getting emerged in the contemporary artificial life movement and also have some understanding of the history. And I think what will be interesting in the next few years is if there is as we've seen with regards to some degree of reemergence of a kind of hobbyist artificial life community, whether there will be a group of artificial life philosophers that won't necessarily have to hitch their wagons to Kurzweil at all, but will be able to, you know, in some regard, come to people like Gerald or Jeffrey or these kind of folk and ask them questions, which then provoke their own writing. Gerald, in terms of your approaches, do you think about seeking out philosophy students and these kind of people with regards to your development?
No, I was just going to ask you, do you think there's a philosophy of model trains?
I think there, in some regard, I think there is. I think there, if you look at the topology associated, now we're really thoroughly digressing here, but if you look at the topology of track theory, there is certainly, and this goes back to real trains as well. So in all of these kind of niche engineering nerd areas, there is a group that take it to extreme levels. So I think every aspect of what you would think would be normally mundane has the potential to have philosophical schools that have come along with it and certainly move into academia. I don't think we're relatively unique in that. But I do think what we talk about is considerably more fundamental and touches on, as you've discussed already, Gerald, ideas of consciousness and biology, plants and movements into, you know, animals, and all these kind of things seem to come through artificial life tinkering. And certainly the other aspect that I like that I've already referenced is our ability to raise our hand to the likes of Bostrom and say, sorry, actually, it's not quite like that. So I think certainly there is a, you know, there is potential for folks that are philosophically inclined to come to people such as yourself or Jeffrey or read their primary works, and I've been flicking through some of those recently as well, and start developing philosophical ideas based on that. So I think there's a two-way street.
One thing about this is that I would say, you know, it's a kind of thought experiment with, you know, actual visualizable results. So, you know, at the same time as being a food for philosophical thinking for someone who considers that to be their profession or one of the main interests, it's also, I would think, more effective as a way to get people who normally wouldn't think philosophically to think more philosophically, because you're actually, you know, confronting them with a really interesting philosophical question. And even if it's not their business to do philosophy, this might, you know, bring the philosopher out in a bunch of people. And I like that aspect of it.
Certainly, certainly. And I think this, in some regard, returns to the idea of, and I go back to Rushkoff here, the idea of kind of a militancy with regards to the way we describe things. I was thinking today with regards to U.S. politics, because it strikes me that there is so little difference between the two major parties in the U.S., that really it is the minor differences that are exploded. And this is really the idea with regards to how we should communicate information through a kind of Rushkoff view, that what we need to do rather than say, yes, you know, you've read Kurzweil or you have a sense of that, you pretty well know everything you need to know. You need to say, no, actually, wait, there are all these kind of different interesting things, and focus on the core differences. And I think this is something that's interesting in a kind of thought experiment about how to communicate artificial life, that one can say, well, you know, I tinker with these monkeys in a simulation, or one can say, you know, it raises questions with regards to what a simulation is. You know, is the road system a simulation? Is, you know, the financial system a simulation? Are we all monkeys in a simulation in some regard? And I think the ability to kind of rephrase questions both with regards to existing popular theory and the distinctions between what we're all doing to existing popular theory, and kind of exploding that in a greater way, and also thinking about the way that we frame what we discuss, is really critical in terms of motivating the kind of philosophical thought that you're talking about, Gerald. What's your thinking with regards to this kind of communication, Bruce?
I think that for the lay person, it's just getting them to understand sort of the mechanisms of life, of a living system, at the most sort of abstract level. Some of them are kind of turned off, and they just don't see it. And others get fascinated, and then they start asking all those philosophical questions that you're pointing out. So I think it's, as educators of the public, if that's what we are, sometimes, you know, there isn't a single time that I've done a biota type event to the public that it hasn't led to a huge amount of questions, and a subset of the people really start asking these questions. and they really think about it. So I think it's an igniter for a whole philosophical discussion that has to happen more nowadays in the 21st century, I think.
Certainly. I mean, I think what I was discussing with regards to highlighting the differences is really about instigating that kind of thinking, even in people that would be genuinely normally disinterested, saying to them, everything that you know about this may be, you know, prefaced on something which may not be factually correct. So maybe there are different things that you need to be thinking about. And I think that method of framing information comes through, you know, reading classical and in some degree continental philosophy as well. I mean, there's Sartre and Foucault and that kind of instigation. In terms of communicating artificial life with a particular philosophical context, Gerald, I reflect on your demonstration to the architects. If you were going to demonstrate Darwin at home to try and instigate the kind of deeper philosophy in the thinking of an artificial life disinterested or mildly artificial life curious audience, how would you do that?
Well, the way I would frame it is in terms of, like, this is what we're doing is we're sort of polishing the mirror, and you know, we're able to see more of what it is that makes us up, and you know, we know that we came from a long line of you know, replicators, and we're also, you know, obligated to replicate ourselves in order to proceed into the future. So it's core to the whole thing. And when you're building stuff that's based on the same principle and sort of as a, you know, practical, visualizable thought experiment, these are things that you know, it's polishing the mirror. It's finding a new way to reflect on what it is we are.
So I know you haven't had the opportunity to read Bruce's writing in Dick Gordon's book yet, but were you able to listen to last week's podcast with regards to Bruce's discussion of the God proof?
I heard it, but I don't remember.
Okay, so in terms of polishing a mirror, Bruce has been talking through the Dick Gordon book and also occasionally in these podcasts with regards to the idea that artificial life could break the mirror in some regard, that it could be something critical that could go back and would actually instigate discussion in the Richard Dawkins Foundation mailing list from last week's discussion. So what's your thinking with regards to the potential that artificial life, rather than polishing the mirror, could actually break the mirror?
You're asking me this?
Well, Bruce, do you want to talk a little bit more about this for Gerald's benefit and the listening audience's benefit?
I think, yeah, I love Gerald's metaphor of creating a better mirror for ourselves. I think that's just beautifully said, Gerald. And I think that the mirror that this can create is a complete reformatting of understanding where stuff comes from and how things work. And that's probably what we need as a species if we're going to manage our planet better and ourselves and get out of religious fanaticism and whatnot. I mean, if you look at the miracle, if you would, of the evolution of life in 4 billion years, and you really understand that and you really stand in the presence of that and the complexity of how living things work, you don't need any miracles from religion. You know, this kind of thing's been written for a couple of hundred years. The wonder of nature is all you need. And religions are merely, you know, stories people tell each other about things. That those stories have changed, and the stories are misused. But if you stand in awe of nature and the universe, that's the only religion you need.
In terms of the idea of this new mirror, can we talk about the potential for components of artificial life to sufficiently change the old mirror in such a way to potentially impact all that we've discussed with regards to philosophy so far? Bruce, what's your thinking with regards to that?
I think that and one of the things I want to do for the PhD is really to help build and polish a mirror, a Gerald's mirror. And to do that, I think you can use some really powerful tools. And one of those is 3D computer graphics, animated computer graphics, which I've been in the business now for 15 years. And we're doing a simulation / movie to show how you could protect the Earth from asteroids that are going to make a direct impact by using gravity tractor solutions. And we're building a 2 to 3 minute movie to show, it'll be showed to governments, leaders, television programs, whatever, it'll be disseminated widely to communicate the importance of doing missions as preparatory missions. So if one day we had to do it, we could. And I think doing Artificial Life the movie or Evolution the movie, from our perspective as engineers, as building blocks people, where we could communicate how it could be that the world we know, the world that's made out of copies of things, does emerge from this simple property of copying, and copying from blueprints.
Yeah, it's, you could think of it as yet another step in our understanding, in the sense that at one point the Earth was the center of the universe, and now we know that the Earth is not necessarily the center of the universe. In fact, by the way, I saw a where you could buy T-shirts, really, really funny T-shirts that were based on the theme Teach the Controversy. And one of them was Teach the Controversy, and it had a geocentric view of the universe. So people had to understand the geocentric view of the universe. So artificial life is yet another way to say, wait a second, how special are we exactly?
So in terms of this idea that all we need is an accurate visual representation, I think this is an interesting thing that I think about with regards to what I do with Noble Eight, because I think there is... If we are just doing that, then we are merely just producing, high school biological movies in some regard. What's interesting with regards to artificial life is the ability to create something that's actually slightly deeper, almost change the language with regards to these things and create elements. And I think this is rephrasing Dick Gordon's challenge. Create elements which actually explain a little more, bit more about the biological world in some regard. Do you see that visualization is the primary way to express this, Bruce, or do you see that we need to actually create a new language around something like Dick Gordon's challenge?
I think we need a new language and we need stories. And when I do my talks at Burning Man, that's kind of my, will it play in Peoria? A dome of 50 to 150 people.
Semi-clothed.
Semi-clothes in this odd environment, who I've got to keep their attention for an hour, and I have to bring them through a personal experience. So I literally have people close their eyes and visualize something in terms of evolution or early life on Earth, and the ones that don't open their eyes and they're off asleep and I've lost them. But I just try to do anything I can to take them on the journey and to immerse them. And at Burning Man, you have no visual, you have no PowerPoint or no visual, so it's all done by some odd-shaped person standing there in a dusty outfit in a dome. So that's been a vision of mine, to be able to communicate this actually purely with story and visualization in the mind and the imagination.
Yes, I think the emotive elements of your Burning Man presentations are something that has certainly impacted me. I mean, I know more about you, even though we've been in correspondence and long-term communication for probably more than a decade now. I know more about you through those hour-long intervals of the Burning Man presentations than through, hours of telephone calls and, probably tens of thousands of words of email communication. So can you talk a little bit about the emotive element in the Burning Man presentations?
Yeah, it's basically you have to sort of grab the whole person. You have to make it personal. So, for example, one of the exercises I try to do is to try to get people to picture, just close their eyes and picture this swimming worm. And you think, oh, that's pretty odd. But the swimming worm is this silvery thing and kind of in semi-warm water, moving along, and it's actually the first thing with a notochord, 600 and some million years ago, and it's their ancestor. And I basically say, that is you. That is a version of you. There's a direct line that goes from that to you of creatures that fought, struggled, survived terrible odds to reproduce. And every single creature in between that one and you is an ancestor, and you belong to that lineage. It's personal, it is unique, like a snowflake. There's no one else that has the same lineage. And it kind of gets us, some people get it, because they identify with some little creature, and then they think of, gee, that a piece of that creature is inside of every cell in my body, and my backbone is that creature.
Ironically, that's exactly what Roy Plotnick did in the Biota podcast about Can Artificial Life Explain the Cambrian Explosion? And the period where he describes the kind of irking of intelligence in terms of moving between feeding grounds is really a profound moment in my own thinking, just to hear that said. And I think you're exactly right. Now, in terms of this emotive component, this is something which you've described in the Burning Man performance, and obviously with Roy as well, occurred through audio. What strengths does the visual medium give to that, or is this just a pure idea that can be expressed in audio alone?
You could really, and this perhaps is the subject of my PhD work, is going to be exactly this. You could really create a powerful marriage of the two. One of the examples of this is in Santa Cruz, they premiered this Life on Earth performance that was a marriage of the photographer Fritz Lanting, did this tremendous piece of tremendous photographer, and this spoken word piece, and it was actually a whole symphonic, it was a whole musical production, and I missed the actual full production. I got to go to the talk afterwards, but it was supposedly very moving. And it was yet spoken word, visual, video, and it's that kind of thing that can really reach. You know, the audience going there is probably fairly highly, you know, college educated and whatnot to be interested. But it's that kind of thing. And if you look at the TED site, the Technology Education Design Conference, those talks there, you know, from whether it's Aubrey de Grey and his long beard, or other people, very very powerful talks. With visuals sometimes, and there's a whole movement worldwide to kind of create things that aren't PowerPoint bullets, that are moving and that aren't overly tech, but tell a story, but don't disengage people from the speaker. And I think that's a craft that's emerging now, and I'd like to try to do that for artificial life.
Certainly. And whilst it wasn't Burning Man, Gerald, reflecting on the video that I saw of you talking in front of the architects, unfortunately the background screen with the text on it was sufficiently blurred that really all we had as viewing the video was your audio presentation and movement. Whilst I don't think the first Grey Thumb meeting will be in any way analogous to a desert flyer like Burning Man is, what is your own thinking in terms of communicating in full? Well, Grey Thumb is a bit artificial because obviously you've got artificial life interested folk that are coming together. But in terms of this idea of an emotive narrative, how does that resound with your own work?
Well, I'm thinking right now about, like Bruce was talking just now about, you know, this very primitive creature that's an ancestor. One of the wonderful books of Dawkins was The Ancestor's Tale, where he actually turns time backwards and starts now and goes back into the past and describes the places at which we share an ancestor yet again with the animal kingdom and with everything else. And if you go far enough back, of course, you reach a point where we share an ancestor with the plants. So I want to come back to this idea of plant life, artificial life, because you know, if you're sitting there scratching your head saying, have we achieved artificial life, or is this simulation actually demonstrating some artificial life, are you ready to say, yes, eureka, it's a plant? You know, would people be ready for that? Would that mean enough to people? I mean, it is a fact that we share a common ancestor with plants, so we should be excited if we can say, hey, it's a plant.
Well, you're on the line with two avid gardeners, so I think we are certainly you're preaching to the choir in that regard with regards to the two participants on the call other than yourself.
Gardening is actually a perfect analogy for what I call intelligent design, you know, where you're trying to forge a collaboration between an algorithm and a person with, you know, the intelligence. So, the analogy to gardening is just perfect. And I use it often when I'm talking to the architects. They're saying, you know, what we're going to do, what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to build a garden for you. And I want you guys to come in here and, snip off the weeds and you know, sculpt the plants the way they should be and decide what should, what should be supported and what shouldn't. So I want to turn the architects into gardeners.
So with 5 minutes remaining, Gerald, I wanted you to distill to the biota community what the Nuance Engine is and why, if they have any interest with regards to the components of the Nuance Engine, they should get in contact with you immediately and review the Darwin at Home podcast.
Yeah, well, I hope to be able to give a bit of a first public discussion to the Nuance Engine at the Graycom meeting on Tuesday. But what it is it provides a mapping between what you might call a genotype and a phenotype. And the genotype goes right back to the total, you know, the absolute core of computing. It's just ones and zeros. It's just a stream of ones and zeros. And on the other end, you've got a very convenient way in Java of setting up a kind of an instruction set. And the idea is that the instructions are nuanced, which means that you could think of them as sort of like assembly instructions for a CPU, but then they moderate their behavior based on nuances that they might receive. So the idea is basically you've got, you know, ones and zeros coming in, and you've got instructions being executed on the other side. So that can be mapped onto, and that can be put into the core of any number of different kinds of projects. And the first thing that I'm going to try and put it into is the growth of tensegrities. That's, you know, it's a very esoteric, specialized domain to apply it to, but I think it can be applied to a huge variety of things. You're talking bits on the one hand and instructions on the other hand, and it leads me on to build a sort of a separate module that does the bit manipulations, which is, you know, the quintessential blind watchmaker, with no idea what the genotype is producing. It just sits there and manipulates ones and zeros in a stream. So I think this is an interesting approach to, you know, generally genotype phenotype mapping.
Fascinating. Well, with 3 minutes remaining, I'd like to thank you both for the ability to chat this evening, and hopefully within the next few days we'll be able to establish whether we can get Claude and potentially some of his students on the next BIOS Live and when we'll actually be holding it. But I'll certainly put an announcement if we do change the time from 8 p.m. Pacific on the BIOTA podcast page. It will be sometime the next day if we do. So, you'll be able to make next week's discussion, won't you, Bruce?
Yes, I should be able to. It's my last one before starting a long journey via Esalen to England.
Wow. Ideally, I guess Justin and a few other folk would organize something as well, so you'd have a few talks and a few things to do while you're over in the UK. So I'm putting that out so that if you want to take a trip to Brighton for the day, I'm sure there are quite a few folk from the Graytham Brighton community that would be interested in meeting you and hearing the Graytham message from someone who I think has probably attended almost all of them, although you haven't yet attended a Graytham Netherlands yet.
Oh, I'd love to meet anyone in the UK area involved in or interested in it.
Terrific. So next week, as we've been talking about, the artificial life of plants, potentially with primary theorists, potentially with philosophical discussions, but no doubt a lively conversation will be had sometime next week with regards to the artificial life of plants. Thank you all very much for listening. Look forward to you listening next week.